It is Wednesday, August 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, we look at the escalating tensions between North Korea and the United States.
South Korea has been a potential target here for the last 70 years.
ASEAN criticizes China's actions in the South China Sea, and the popular music group The Chainsmokers has a new single and a new tour. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump, in the midst of an exchange of threats with North Korea, declared Wednesday that the United States' nuclear arsenal is now far stronger and more powerful than ever before. Trump's latest assessment of the country's potent military strength came a half day after he issued a stark warning to North Korea, saying if Pyongyang continues its threats against the United States, they will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. But his top diplomat, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, sought Wednesday to downplay the threats Pyongyang and Trump have leveled at each other in the aftermath of new UN sanctions imposed on North Korea last weekend. They're aimed at cutting $1 billion of its export income and attempting to force it to halt its nuclear weapons development. I spoke with VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Padden in Seoul and asked him to describe the mood in the South Korean capital as the threats between North Korea and the United States continue.
Well, while a lot of the talk in the U.S. seems to be very ratcheted up and there seems to be a kind of DEFCON 4 level of concern about the North Korea nuclear threat, here in Seoul, people are on summer vacation, and it is not as big an issue as one would suppose.
Now, in your talks with some regional security analysts, what have they had to say about this situation? Because this is a relatively new U.S. president, and he's dealing with a situation with North Korea where it seems to be increasingly testing missiles. And what have they had to say about it?
Well, I think here a lot of the analysts I talk to continue to believe that the issues of deterrence and the concern over mutual assured destruction should either side in this Korean standoff attempt, a major attack on the other, continues to hold, even though North Korea is continuing to work on its long-term nuclear missile threat. South Korea has been a potential target here for the last 70 years, and North Korea has the capability to, as it has described, rain fire upon Seoul and most of the north of South Korea and at least half the population if war were to ever quickly break out. South Korea also has the capability to intensely attack North Korea, and with the U.S. at its side, most war planners say that the U.S. would eventually win a war with North Korea if it ever came to that, although the cost would be catastrophic and millions of lives could be lost. So that standoff continues to hold here in South Korea. The fact that Kim Jong-un is developing a newer range of missiles that can potentially reach the U.S. does not necessarily here and amongst analysts means that he would be irrational enough to use them in a way that would trigger his own demise, because if he ever used launched a missile against a U.S. target, the U.S. would have to respond with overwhelming force. And the North Korean leadership knows that. So here in South Korea, and the analysts I spoke to believe that continues to be the constraining situation that prevents any real outbreak of conflict here on the Korean Peninsula. The one continuing concern is the new president in the U.S., President Trump, who continues to speak with intense political rhetoric and talks about fire and fury raining down on North Korea, basically taking a page from their own political playbook and threatening intense conflict unless North Korea does something to end its nuclear ambitions. But it remains to be seen whether the U.S. would actually act on such a threat.
Well, the North Korean People's Army released a statement Wednesday saying it's examining plans for a missile strike on the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam. I mean, the fact, though, that they, you know, named this place, it seems like that's something that they're considering.
It's possible that they are considering, that they have the war plans. The fact that they released that statement hours after President Trump talked about North Korea and warned North Korea that the U.S. would respond to any threat with fury never seen before, perhaps was partly the reason for this kind of statement coming out when it happened. I think so far under the Kim Jong-un regime, who's been in power since 2011, there has been no attacks on any South Korean or U.S. facilities. There's been a lot of political rhetoric. There have been missile launches into empty seas. We could see a missile launch into the sea near Guam or some other type of long-distance missile test at some point. But to contemplate that North Korea would actually attempt a long-range missile strike against Guam, which, by the way, Guam has the THAAD missile defense system on its island. So the military base there could technically defend itself against a long-range missile attack. But to contemplate them, it is not in line with North Korea's actions within the last few years. There have been no attacks. So there's been a ratcheting up of rhetoric. It's possible, because the new sanctions came out, that North Korea is drawing a line in the sand and will actually take some sort of suicidal military action, because that's what it would be, and if that happens. But there's a lot of skepticism right now on whether that's just a way for North Korea to taunt President Trump or whether it's a meaningful threat.
That's VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Padden in Seoul. Meanwhile, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis is issuing his own sharp threat to North Korea, saying the regime should cease any consideration of actions that would lead to the end of its regime and the destruction of its people. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, as we were talking about just before we went on air, there seem to be these days where everything kind of happens in terms of anniversaries. And today in the U.S. on social media, we're marking three anniversaries. The first, hashtag Michael Brown. It was on August 9th, 2014, that 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri, which of course kicked off the Black Lives Matter protests there, galvanized that movement. 3 years later, many are mourning Brown's death on social media, and they're wondering if anything has actually changed, if he's died in vain, or if there's been any improvement as far as the treatment of African Americans by police. So lots of people talking about that. It was on August 9th, 1974, that President Richard Nixon resigned from office after the Watergate scandal. And so lots of talk about that in light of the Trump administration. Many have described the Trump presidency already as very Nixonian in terms of the scandals. They're wondering what would happen if President Trump resigned from office. Others are saying, hold on, this is not anything as big as Watergate. You're blowing this out of proportion. It's being exaggerated. But the comparisons are being made across social media. And then finally, something that relates to what we were just talking about with North Korea, hashtag Nagasaki Day, August 9th, 1945, 72 years ago, that the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki, Japan, killing as many as 80,000, of course, 3 days after dropping the bomb in Hiroshima. In light of the escalating tensions with North Korea, many are remembering this day and talking about the consequences of nuclear weaponry, and especially in a new light given these new threats. So people remembering 72 years ago what happened and hoping that nothing like that will ever happen again.
Yeah, hopefully, yes. All right, well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that we're following. The harsh rhetoric between North Korea and U.S. President Donald Trump worries investors. Hundreds gather to show solidarity at a firebombed mosque in Minnesota. Police arrest a man suspected of a car attack on French soldiers near Paris. And the author of a Google diversity memo files a labor complaint after his firing. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new U.S.-Swiss study suggests tailors and dressmakers and others who make their living with a needle and thread have very sharp 3D or stereoscopic vision. Scientists say stereoscopic vision is the result of the brain interpreting 2D imaging information from each eye, which together provides us with 3D depth perception. Depth perception is what helps us make our way through our three-dimensional world. To reach their findings, the researchers administered computerized perceptual tasks to dressmakers and non-dressmaker volunteers. The research indicated that dressmakers are 80% more accurate than non-dressmakers at computing the distance between themselves and objects they were looking at. And 43% of them were also better at estimating the distance between objects. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at the danger of opioid drugs. The United States, Australia, and Japan this week criticized China's ongoing land reclamation, construction of outposts, and militarization of disputed features in the South China Sea. The joint statement said any future code of conduct must be legally binding, meaningful, and effective. They also called for respect for last year's international arbitration ruling, dismissing much of Beijing's claim to the waterway. Late Sunday, the 10 foreign ministers of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, issued a joint communique that, without mentioning China, emphasized the importance of non-militarization and self-restraint in the disputed South China Sea. Carl Thayer, professor emeritus at the University of New South Wales, told International Edition's Victor Beatty the ASEAN communique was the product of compromise among the varying interests of ASEAN's members.
Vietnam was obviously definitely the one pushing strongest for even for a legally binding code of conduct, and that section was removed. And there are other quibbles along the way. But it's clear that Cambodia and the Philippines were those most active in trying to delete and succeeding all the critical references. This is a general statement setting out ASEAN's basic boilerplate policies without the elaboration. They took note that some ministers expressed concern. That's been in the communiques for a long time. And then they've turned, instead of talking about militarization, non-militarization as a way of softening that blow, but Malaysia wanted military assets to be included in the text. That was deleted. Vietnam wanted extended construction. That's been deleted. The point being, this is setting the stage for the next round, that ASEAN and China, having approved this framework code of conduct, they are now about to enter into what the ASEAN statement calls substantive negotiations, and China prefers the word consultations. So the next round is trying to work out the actual text of a code of conduct, and whether it's legally binding or not, I think, is still on the table. But China is opposing it quite strongly.
Overall, is this an advancement for China's interests?
It is, but what ASEAN is playing to is that this is a pregnant moment because of the discussions on the code of conduct, and it doesn't want to muddy the waters. Cambodia is always motivated to get out in front of China and clear the waves for it by taking anything that China could find offense. And that ASEAN, I guess, overall would be concerned that if they misstep, China could react strongly and drag its heels a bit more. China has shaped the ground. It shapes how they word their statements. For example, they keep mentioning the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and China totally rejects the decisions made under that by an arbitral tribunal. ASEAN keeps reaffirming it, but yet it won't even mention that decision. So it's a victory for China. Why would China say it supports UN Convention when it won't accept the compulsory dispute settlement mechanism which it ratified when it signed on to it?
Carl Thayer, Professor Emeritus at the University of New South Wales. U.S. President Donald Trump says the United States had no alternative but to defeat an epidemic of opioid drug use, which kills more than 100 Americans daily. Speaking from his golf club in New Jersey, Trump said the drug abuse in the country has quadrupled in the past two decades, while efforts to stem it have diminished. He promised measures to combat the scourge, including tougher prosecution of drug-related crimes, better controls at the southern U.S. border, where most of the opioids are smuggled into the country, medical treatment, and preventing the addiction. VOA's Lata Sahok has more.
Flanked by his wife Melania and Secretary of Health and Human Services Tom Price, Trump told reporters the drug epidemic threatens every segment of the U.S. population.
Drug overdose is now the leading cause of accidental death in the United States, and opioid overdose deaths have nearly quadrupled since 1999. It is a problem the likes of which we have not seen.
Trump blamed the crisis on the previous administration, saying federal prosecutions of drug-related crimes have decreased by 23% between 2011 and 2016, while the average sentence length for convicted federal drug offenders has shortened. He promised to reverse the trend.
We're also very, very tough on the southern border, where much of this comes in. We're talking to China, where certain forms of man-made drug comes in, and it is bad. We're speaking to other countries, and we're getting cooperation.
A commission created to study the problem urged the president last week to declare a national emergency to address opioid abuse. Secretary Price said 52,000 Americans have died from overdose in 2015 and that the numbers are growing. He said his agency will work to ensure treatment and recovery for all addicts and support research on how to treat pain without narcotics.
One of the things that we've done to try to bring a voice to it and bring faces to it is to go around the country in multiple states and to visit communities. And try to find those best practices. What's working out there? What hasn't worked? Talk with those families that have been devastated by the addiction crisis. Talk with folks who've been addicts and have recovered. What is it that worked?
Price said the National Institutes of Health is working on developing a vaccine for addiction and pain medication that is not addictive. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day. Bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. A highly successful pop group has a new single. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins me with the details.
We've got one of the hottest bands on the planet right now. They're known as the Chain Smokers, Andrew Taggart and Alex Paul. These guys come from New York City. They put their band together about 7-8 years ago. They've released a couple of EPs. And in April, they put out their debut album, which is called Memories Do Not Open. The album went to number one. They've had a few big hits off the album, including a song that was number one for 12 straight weeks called Closer, which is Chainsmokers, and that features Halsey. A lot of people know that song. And you realize, if you think about it, there's only two songs that have been on the charts at number one longer than 12 weeks. Number one would be One Fine Day, Mariah Carey and Boyz II Men, which was 16 weeks at number one. And number two was Uptown Funk with Bruno Mars and Mark Ronson. That was number one for 14 weeks. So they're going to be in history, I guess you can say. They're currently on tour for the album, and they've just announced they're going to be performing in New York Central Park as a part of the Global Citizens Music Festival. The date is September 23rd. It'll be broadcast live on MSNBC.com and iHeartRadio. Last year's concert in Central Park raised about $30 billion. And they're hoping to do the same. Also on the bill, Green Day, The Killers, Stevie Wonder, Alessia Cara, Andra Day, quite a few acts, but today it's all about chain smokers, and we're going to listen to their brand new song, which is called Honest, right here on International Edition. If I'm being honest, if I'm being honest,
you said I should be honest. Now, didn't they have another song between Closer and this one, something about Paris or?
Yes, exactly. They had, well, what a good memory. See, you're a fan. You're a closet fan. I knew it. Yes. Paris, and they also have a song that's out currently that's been lingering on the charts with Coldplay, something just like this. And so the band are on tour. They were asked how they came up with the name Chainsmokers. What does that mean? Cigarette smoking? No. Has to do with marijuana smoking.
Oh.
So that's what they decided to go with, the name Chainsmokers. And as I mentioned, they're on tour. The tour hasn't been selling well for some odd reason or another. They're not selling out everywhere they perform, which is kind of strange for a group that has already won a Grammy, and they're nominated for an MTV award at the Video Music Awards on August 27th. Quite a popular act, and they've been on the charts quite a bit, starting with their very first chart hit called Selfie. But there you go. That's Chainsmokers, and Honesty is their new song.
Well, maybe they'll get more visibility now.
Yeah, as a result of International Edition.
Well, hopefully. I don't know about that. Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. But you're not the only one on my mind. If I'm being honest. If I'm being honest. You said. And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
August marks the third anniversary of the assault by ISIS terrorists on the Yazidi community in northern Iraq, during which they sought to destroy this people and their culture. The brutality of the events marked both a disaster for the Yazidi community and a turning point in the fight against ISIS. On August 3, 2014, ISIS terrorists overran the city of Sinjar in northern Iraq. The town had a population of 90,000 people, most of them Yazidis, with a small Shia minority. Yazidis are a non-Muslim religious and ethnic minority. They have been viciously targeted and persecuted by ISIS for their beliefs and have been frequently attacked throughout their history by others. When ISIS seized control of Sinjar and the surrounding countryside, they immediately began to destroy Yazidi shrines and to slaughter Yazidi civilians. Thousands of people, particularly men and boys, were executed, while thousands more, especially women and girls, were abducted and raped as sex slaves by ISIS fighters. Of the 200,000 people who fled their homes in the city and the surrounding villages, some 50,000 took refuge on Mount Sinjar. There they were surrounded and trapped by ISIS fighters. Within 3 days, dozens of Yazidis, nearly all of them children, began to die of dehydration. They called family around the world, including in America, begging for help to escape the siege. On August 4, 2014, the Emir of Yazidi called on the world leaders for assistance. The United States responded, conducting airstrikes against ISIS militants, supporting the delivery of humanitarian assistance through airdrops of food and water, and working with Iraqi and other partners. This was the first action that led to the formation of the International Coalition to Defeat ISIS and the beginning of the end for ISIS. By mid-December of 2014, Kurdish forces launched the first phase of the campaign to expel ISIS from Sinjar, liberating parts of Sinjar city before the year's end. On November 13, 2015, a day after launching a second offensive, Kurdish and Yazidi forces, backed by coalition airstrikes, fully regained control of Sinjar from ISIS. The fight against ISIS is a fight of civilization against barbarism. Nowhere was this more clearly demonstrated than in Sinjar.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.